Yep, that's right, Dave. Right about now, it's about 10 to 6 Winnipeg time. Fun-loving criminals are on stage. They're going through a bit of a sound check. And we had a chance to be here earlier this afternoon to see the setup of the actual stage. And it really is something amazing. I'm not going to give too much away. And in a few minutes, we're going to bring Howie B on the air live. Of course, he was responsible for a lot of the really interesting sounds on the new record called Pop. But we had a chance to hear the band sound checking, hear you two sound checking. And as sound checks go, it didn't sound too bad.
Cool. And are people starting to filter outside? And is the city sort of swept up with Pop Mart fever?
You couldn't have put it in a better way, as a matter of fact. The city is so swept up. There was today in the Winnipeg Free Press, there was like a 5-page pullout about the show. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the biggest shows ever to come through Winnipeg, I think second only to the Rolling Stones.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah, I'm getting nods from Winnipeg folks. So, yeah, it's a very big deal here in town. Everybody is buzzing about it.
And speaking of buzzing, let's just hope not too many of those Winnipeg mosquitoes are out there tonight at the show. You know, okay, let's hang on right there. Let's just get to our last traffic break, and we'll come back and go right back to Winnipeg, okay?
Sounds great with me, Dave.
Sounds good. Okay, it's 6:50. Kim's in Winnipeg, and Sandra's got traffic. We're back on Live in Toronto. Dave Bookman here at 204 Yonge. Kim Hughes is in Winnipeg, where she is among the lucky people getting a chance to be the first Canadians, unless some people, I guess, went to Las Vegas, but getting a chance to see you two tonight in Winnipeg. And Kim, what's going on?
Well, as a matter of fact, Dave, just this morning at the airport, producer Rob Johnston and I ran into a couple of people who were actually flying down from Toronto for this show. So clearly, a lot of people just couldn't wait until October when the tour rolled into SkyDome. But just one thing I want to reiterate again that we'd mentioned a minute ago is how big this is to this town. I mean, you really can't overemphasize enough. It's like everybody is in on this. There's just posters all over the city. Every record store, it seems, has a U2 display in the window. And they're expecting something in the neighborhood of, I think, about 43,000 people to come for this, as we mentioned, the second biggest show ever in Winnipeg behind the Rolling Stones. So you just can't believe it. It was funny. We were sitting in the stands just as U2 was sound checking and checking out the big stage there, and they brought in the security, and it was just the weirdest thing. It was just like this huge wall of guys wearing these little red flaps coming in. So it's an enormous event.
Well, you even mentioned that it's so big and so many people have come in that hotel rooms were totally scarce.
Yeah, that's totally true. As a matter of fact, the band, this is another funny story. The band got into town last night, and because it was such a big story, all of the daily newspapers, the local news, local radio, they all wanted to be at the airport and covering the arrival of the band. Well, as it turned out, the band was a little bit late flying in from New York City. They were scheduled to come at around 5, ended up not getting in till 11, and according to our source here, most of the TV and radio newspapers waited at the airport until 11 o'clock in order to see the band actually touch down. It was sort of like me a sense of watching the old, you know, Beatles and waiting for them to arrive at the airport. And by all accounts, the band was very gracious. Just one more very quick story. There was a fellow who was in a record store today and just sort of looking around, taking in the scene. And this guy came running in with a record that he got signed. He's like, I got this signed. And the fellow in the record store was like, well, how did that happen? And it turned out that this fellow was a huge U2 fan, lives here in Winnipeg, and was going out on the town today and just thought, well, what the heck? I might as well carry a record with me. Who knows what'll happen? Well, sure enough, he walks into a very small cafe here in downtown Winnipeg, and who's sitting having lunch alone in the cafe but Bono? So the guy waits until he's finished his lunch, goes over, asks him to sign the record, and just goes to show you never leave the house without a CD cover when your favorite band's in town.
Absolutely. So what would you like to do here? Should we spin a U2 track right now?
You could definitely spin a U2 track. As we mentioned, Howie B is going to be joining us. So we were up here in the press box right now, and certainly anyone who is into the Pop record will know that this guy played a very big role in terms of mixing and helping to record the album and producing as well. So he should have some good stories, and we'll get to some music from him. So take your pick.
Okay, let's do a little, it's probably what you're doing now as it starts the sun in the west. Does the sun rise in the west or does it set in the west? It's one of the sunsets in the west, doesn't it?
I think that's right, yes.
Okay, so I can say that if you look up into the western skies, you're probably staring at the sun. You too on Toronto's New Rock, 102.1 The Edge. Loving Criminals and, of course, Scooby Snacks out in Winnipeg. They're supporting you two tonight. And Kim, you getting any Scooby Snacks out there?
Well, we did have a chance to see them soundcheck, and hopefully we'll be able to stick around and see them perform. We are waiting for Howie not B here yet, but hopefully, of course, as we mentioned, anyone who knows Pop, his name is certainly familiar, and the people sort of into dance music in general. We should mention, Dave, that after the concert tonight, that is to say, after U2's concert tonight, we are going to be in conversation with the group. Apparently, they do interviews after their show, which is fine by us. So I do imagine we'll be sitting down with a couple of members, Bono for sure, probably Adam Clayton, maybe Larry Mullen, and we'll be able to air some clips of that tomorrow on the program, and also on Monday in anticipation of the two shows that U2 is doing in Skydome in October.
And one thing you got to ask to see if you can shake it out of them is that who do you think we'll be getting by the time October rolls around and supporting them, because they are such great bands all along the way, so I think we're all curious to find out who we're going to get in October.
Well, not only that, but certainly there's been some bands that have been quite public in the fact that they were asked and turned them down. I mean, specifically, Prodigy is one group that I do believe was offered to go out with the band this time around and decided that they would rather do it on their own and try to crack America that way. But yeah, we'll certainly try to get into that territory if possible.
Cool. We are live from both 204 Young and Kim's out in Winnipeg. Let's take a break and we'll come back. We're back on Live in Toronto, and of course, with the big event out in Winnipeg tonight, it's not the only big thing happening. North by Northeast is launching in our city tonight here, and it's our night in Winnipeg with U2, and we're going to go back live to the Winnipeg Stadium, and Kim is there.
Hi, Dave. I am here in Winnipeg. We are at Winnipeg Stadium, where you two are going to be performing a little bit later on this evening. We're just up in the press box right now, and just before they let people into the stadium. And with us in the press box is Mr. Howie B., a man who is known to anybody who owns a copy of Pop and anyone who follows the UK scene. Hey, welcome.
Hi. How you doing?
It's very nice to have you, and thanks for taking some time out for us. So let's talk about this tour and this album. I mean, when you were making this record, was touring always something that you thought you'd be doing, or?
I never thought, I knew they'd be doing it, but I never thought I'd be doing it. Because whenever we were routining the songs, the main thing that they were saying whenever we were recording it was, we've got to take this live. But I never thought I would be here live doing it with them, like being behind the desk and spinning discs before they come on. So no, I didn't think I'd be here. It's magic being here though.
It must be fairly extraordinary too, because one of the things that sort of strikes you looking at this is the kind of contrast between the high-tech stage setup and the excitement that people are feeling. I mean, the people are coming from a very human place, you know, kind of spiritually, and then you're up sort of ensconced in this thing. So you're sort of creating that bridge between it, aren't you?
Well, there's a little bit of a, I mean, the main thing is, there's humans behind all of that anyway, so it's like it looks very technical, but it's just this humans controlling it all. We're all there. It's like a very social thing behind it, and it's just the thing, the trick is to get that across, I think, and that's, I'm part of that, trying to get, play some records and get a little vibe of just an uplifting vibe before the band come on, between the fun loving criminals. So yeah, it's trying to get the social thing across through this madness is difficult, but I think we're doing it.
Right. For people who are reading the liner notes in Pop, I mean, they'll see your name credited for mixing and recording and doing a lot of different things. You're not listed as a referee, although I suspect that there might have been an element of that to your job. Certainly, given the amount of people who are in the studio, not just the musicians, but, you know, various people coming in and out. Was it sort of a tense recording?
There was moments of tenseness, but that was all down. Most of it, the tense moments were related to food. It was like food moments, whether it could have been a bad meal or something like that. That's when things get really tense. Apart from that, it was like, you know, might have been a few hi-hat problems or something like that, or a few little tuning problems, but there was no, in the actual studio itself, it was just like a case of hard work. So there wasn't any tenseness there.
It's true. People are always happy once they've got a full belly. I mean, it's always the way.
And if the belly's not full, then they're not going to work. Mm. Or if it's full and it's not nice, then there's complaints. So there you go.
For those just joining us in Toronto, we are live from Winnipeg. We're speaking with Howie B. We are looking out at this incredible, incredible scene where the Pop Mart Tour has landed. It's going to be, I guess, striking up at around 9:30 this evening. Fun Loving Criminals opening, as we mentioned, a little bit earlier. And I guess just with respect to the scene in the United Kingdom right now, I mean, we're reading so much. It seems like every new thing that comes out says, well, you know, North America, get ready. I mean, it's coming. Electronic music is coming for
right.
you. But it's sort of interesting because it seems, with respect to sort of the whole dance culture and certainly what's happening in clubs, anytime something becomes even remotely mainstream, everyone's going off in a totally different direction.
Right.
So, again, it must put you in sort of an interesting position, wanting to be kind of on the vanguard of any new movement that's happening in electronic music in the UK, but also
yeah.
trying to reach out to people in North America who are starting to get hip to this kind of music, right?
Well, the most interesting thing is the tags, is the names that people give it. Like, you're calling it electronic music. 2 years ago, it was called trip-hop, and I don't know what it's going to be called, something else in about another 6 months' time. But I think that, for me, my... is what I tend to do is just jump. As soon as someone gives me a name or a tag or what I do a tag, then I just jump and jump into, like, if they're giving me like a trip hop tag, then I just go and make an album with U2 and make a rock record which has got elements of the dance culture in it. But I think in terms of the thing that's going to hit like North America, for me anyway, what is badly needed here is some sort of club culture. That's what I seem to be missing here. Seems to happen on the coast, but I can't. And it's maybe people have been taking me to the wrong places or whatever. I mean, that might be the thing, but I think that's what's going to start coming back, because it came from America, it originated here, and I think it's going to come back slowly. I think that's where it's going to come from, the club itself. Whether it comes from a British club or a British, it doesn't make any difference. I think it's going to come from the club, so
right.
I think that's where the interesting thing is going to be happening.
So just before we get into some music, I think we've got a discotheque we're going to play.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not asking you to tell tales out of school, but I sort of am. I mean, any great
yeah.
stories that, behind-the-scenes stories, any fisticuffs in making the record, any give us some juice.
I think it was like Edge cooked this magic meal one evening, and there was like this whole thing of where did it was, I think it was a turnip and pasta dish, and we were just trying to get the recipe off him for that. Then there was another thing where something, one of the meals that we ate was laced with something, and we don't know what it was laced with, but somehow there was like that session that evening was an interesting session.
For what song, just out of curiosity?
For what song? I think it might have been Mofo, actually. I think there was a little bit of funny things going on there for about an evening or two. And there was also a funny boating accident as well that happened. There was one point where we went out for a wee drink, and then all of a sudden we ended up in this like massive big fishing boat there with the captain, and we were there till about 2-3 in the morning. So that was a funny little incident. So there was loads of little incidents like that that kept happening, because there was about 8-9 months we were making it. So every week something would happen. There'd be a bus tour or something like that happening. Crazy.
Maybe an addendum to U2 at the end of the world could be in the future, in your future.
Yeah, something like that, probably.
Howie B, thanks a lot for your time. Best of luck
in
the future.
Much.
Let's go back to Toronto and some music from U2. This is Discotheque on 102.1 The Edge.
And out there for U2, what are you looking at it right now? What's going on?
Well, a very spirited soccer game, apparently between the crew, just broke up. It was happening in the lawns, just at stage right. And, you know, it's difficult to really get a concept of what this stage setup is going to look like in the evening, because so much of it is predicated on the lights. I think people are sort of familiar with the idea of the giant arch. There's also this giant lemon. There's a giant olive on a stick. And certainly there is a kitschy feel, very bright sort of kitschy colors, I guess. The real deal seems to be this enormous screen, which doesn't really look so much like a screen as it does like sort of a scrim hanging down, but apparently it is an electronics masterpiece, and we're going to see it in full action tonight. We did get a bit of a sense of the lights this afternoon when they were trying them out. There's also a very large stage extension, and from what I can gather, just looking at the sound check, the band, the whole band, not just the singer, not just Bono, but the whole band will be at some point in the show performing way out on this extension, so they're just within touch distance of the crowd. We caught up with the band last Thursday at Winnipeg Stadium for the first Canadian date of their Pop Mart tour, which of course is rolling into Toronto and Skydome on October 26th and 27th. Just quickly to set the scene for you, we interviewed the group after their performance, which made for something of a difference in adrenaline, but we were ushered into a small backstage dressing room where the ceilings and the walls were somewhat suitably draped in black. Each member was brought in individually. We began with Edge, then went on to Adam Clayton, and then to Bono. Unfortunately, Unfortunately, Larry Mullen didn't join us this evening, but no problem. When not bumming cigarettes, Bono, our good man and certainly the most talkative of the bunch, got down to business.
So there's a quote that I read of yours way back in the soft, easy days of 1987 that I thought was so funny, and you said, you know, being in a big rock band is a real pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So is it more so now? It seems like it's less so. 5 minutes in your company.
Yeah, I think it's less so. I think it's less so. Was. What date was on that one?
87, I believe.
87, a good year for bummed out quotes. Yeah, I think we spent, I mean, 80s a lot in a kind of retreat from just dealing with being in a big band, just being a, you know, big old rock group. And we thought, you know, trying to dodge it, trying to dodge all the contradictions it threw up. And in the end, I think we spent more energy on that than we spent on being in a band. And then, I mean, I think we always inherently knew it wasn't against the law to be in a big band. But we grew up under Chairman Mao in the sort of the Inkies in England. It was like a Maoist regime, you know what I mean? It was like the Cultural Revolution over there. And the 80s were a miserable time where you weren't allowed to be in a big rock group. And we knew that the reason we started was to be, like, to follow that line where it was, you know, whether it was the Sex Pistols or the Beatles or the Stones or whatever. We knew what we wanted, 16, 17 years old. Let's take this as far as we can. That's when rock and roll is at its most exciting. And it's when it's kicking at the mainstream, biting its ankles, you know. But it wasn't allowed in the 80s. And the British music press broke up most of their great bands from just carping. The Clash went down under that. The Smiths then went down. It's like Echo and the Bunny. They all basically bit the dust. And we were slightly insulated from that because we were in Ireland. We were in Dublin. But we still, I think, carried some of that baggage. Now, of course, in England, it's they've been down on their knees praying for a big band because it all got so boring. And there was a sort of miserabilism that reigned at the end of the 80s. And a lot of the music of the time doesn't stand up now. It just looks very dull, very boring. And things are more bright and more bold now. And so I think it's okay. I think we're part of the reason why that's happened. I think Oasis are part of the reason why that's happened. Radioheads, people like this who are just coming through going, basically just, you know, just stop. Let's just be what we want to be. You know, if you want to write a pop song, let's write a pop song. If we want to write a noise fest, we'll do that. That's our basic blueprint in U2, is to do anything we want.
Toronto's New Rock 102.1, The Edge, Last Night on Earth. That is U2 taken from the pop record. And when we return, words from Edge and also from Adam Clayton and more from Dollar Quote singer Bono. Stay with us.
Maybe the scale of what we're doing has changed. Whether you're seeing us in a stadium or an arena or a theatre or maybe even in a club, it'll basically be the same four guys putting in the same effort. And that's the way it's always been.
You're listening to a special edition of Live in Toronto. Kim Hughes in conversation with U2.
Thanks a lot for staying tuned. We are going strong with U2 until 8 o'clock. Well, even before the start of the Pop Mart Tour in Las Vegas, April 25th, we've been hearing all about the stats and facts and figures about this particular tour, the miles of cable that are used, the size of the LED screen, the mirror ball lemon, the massive road crew, etc., etc. And yet, when you see the show, one thing that you'll definitely notice, in addition to all of these sort of things going on, is that it's very much a performance-based show. That is to say that the band is very out there. They're they're playing, and clearly they want as much of the attention focused on themselves as they do on these various effects that they're carting all over the world. Nevertheless, though, it is fairly difficult to keep a focus on the music and not find yourself overwhelmed by guys stepping out of, well, I won't tell you that part. You'll have to wait until October. Anyways, it is a point that I put to Edge about the expense of the music going the way of the spectacle.
It's something that we're constantly readdressing, is the balance between, as you describe it, the spectacle and what people have really come to see, which is the band performing the songs. And it's something that sometimes, some nights it seems, it airs in one way, and then other nights it airs in the other way. We obviously have this fantastic screen. We have the capability of projecting incredible imagery onto it, so that's something that we do quite a lot in the show. But the thing that I think is most effective, I think, for displaying the performance of the band is simply, you know, shooting the band and having the members of the group on the screen. So we're doing a bit more of that as time goes on, and I think that it is possible to strike that balance whereby there's still a sense of this amazing spectacle, but you still come away feeling like you've seen the performance of the band. And that's really what we're aiming to do here.
And conversely, if somebody was walking away from the stadium tonight and said, "Wow, did you see the lights? Wow, did you see the show?" and didn't really remark on the music, I mean, would that be a point of sorrow for you? Would you feel like you'd miss something? Or would that be okay, too?
I think it's unlikely that they wouldn't come and sort of, you know, notice the music, but they might miss the presence of the band if, you know, in terms of the actual physical performance, if they felt they weren't getting enough of that, that would annoy me. And at the start of the tour, we ourselves felt that there wasn't enough of that, and we've been putting more of that into the show as time has gone on. But basically, all the visuals that are on the screen, no matter how beautiful they are, they really only come alive as a result of the music that the band are performing. It is really a music show, first and foremost, with images and obviously the band.
A deal written in the book, "You Two at the End of the World," talking about how you have to acclimatize when you come off the road and get back into your families and your life and normality. So how does it work the other way? I mean, how do you acclimatize to get back into it?
I suppose it just takes a week or so of just doing it to actually find your touring legs again. And it's, in some ways, it's an easier thing, certainly for me, being on the road and getting into that, because it's really about focus. It's about being able to really concentrate on a 2 hour period of being on stage. So everything is funneled into that time. So I would just say that the transition is more about, you know, finding your feet on stage and, you know, learning to acclimatize to the sound on stage, all the nuances of playing the new songs in front of an audience. Those are the sort of things that take a little while to get to know. But actually, being on the road itself is quite easy to get used to, which is one of the problems, I suppose. It becomes a lifestyle that you get used to very easily.
Which leads back to the beginning, which makes it difficult to acclimatize.
Always,
to get,
yeah,
off it.
It's coming off the road is, I find, more difficult.
2 on 102.1 The Edge in Mysterious Ways. Still a highlight of their live set, although unlike the Zoo TV tour, no belly dancer this time. No, this time the only bellies we get belong to the band. We still have lots more to do with you two and more music to play for you. Please stick around.
Push what you two actually means is what kind of, that's the bit of you two that we're interested in. You know, we're always out chasing the stuff on the fringe of what the band should be doing.
This is a special edition of Live in Toronto. Kim Hughes in conversation with you two.
Thanks a lot for staying tuned in. I am Kim Hughes. Well, U2 is one of those rare bands, one of those very rare bands, that has been going on with the original lineup intact ever since they formed many years ago in Dublin. Their devotion to one another is pretty clear, and it extends to those who work on the sidelines with them. Most of the people who work in their management and publicity have been there from the very beginning, and just as an interesting point, most of them are women. Well, given that, you'd think that the band might have been tempted to stretch out low these many years, maybe doing solo projects, maybe a la Kiss, you know, when they all put out solo albums at the same time. Well, maybe not. But anyways, Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton took some baby steps towards doing work outside of U2 with the Mission Impossible soundtrack. And when we sat down with bass player Adam Clayton, I asked him if he was tempted to take it one step further.
Well, I think, you know, the group functions best as a group. It kind of depends on each member to fulfill the vision that you have for the songs. So we've never particularly had a desire to do things separately. But when we were approached about Mission Impossible, it was so much about, you know, an instrumental, and the way we looked at it was, this is something that a rhythm section can do, because the tune is a well-known tune, and in terms of the European kind of dance and electronica movement, that was something that both Larry and I thought, yeah, let's interpret this melody in that way. So it was kind of, it was unusual that it was an instrumental, so there wasn't a desire or a need to have a singer. It was a case of just backing up a melody as a rhythm section, and I think that was what we enjoyed about it.
But did the project act in any way as a catalyst about, you know, maybe wanting to explore things further, taking it one step further? I mean, I've got in my mind sort of the Rhythmatist, the Stuart Copeland project, where he just went out with a boom mic and, you know, and a drum and see what he brought back.
Maybe at some stage, you know, I mean, that stuff takes a lot of work, and Mission Impossible took a lot of work because, you know, you think it can be done in a weekend, but in actual fact, by the time you've done all the recording, you've chosen the mixes, you kind of cut the record, you find you spend a month on it, and you've got artwork, and then, you know, because it's part of a movie, you get involved in promoting it. So in one sense, you know, as a project, it's kind of, oh yeah, let's go do that, they're easy, no pressure. But very quickly the pressure tends to build because you know, these things always take up more time than you think. But yeah, I mean, maybe you know, over a period of a year, if we were free and we wanted to follow a particular thing, something would happen. I mean, it's a possibility.
On that point specifically, I mean, talking about the group and, you know, being in this group for 20 years, I mean, it sort of occurred to me watching the show that, you know, I sort of had this idea of you too, and yes, there's a band on stage, and there's all these wonderful visuals, but it almost seemed like you too is something that's, you know, it's almost like it's in the ether, you know? It's almost like it's something that is, you know, it's so much, it's almost like a brand name in a way, you know? People don't, you know, or I don't. I mean, I hear the songs and they affect me in a certain way, but then there's, you too. Yes, that band. Do you know what I'm saying? It's almost like it's become an island in a way from its own self.
To some extent, I mean, I know what you're saying, but I think the fact that we always kind of push what U2 actually means is what kind of, that's the bit of U2 that we're interested in. And, you know, the baggage that you talk about, really, which is this thing of this feeling of the brand of what U2 is, we're conscious of it, but it's not the thing we pursue. You know, we're always out chasing the stuff on the fringe of what the band should be doing.
102.1 The Edge, music from U2 and I Will Follow, one of the only pre-war songs that they played in the show. In fact, that song from Boy is the only pre-war song that they play. Nothing from the October album, and also nothing from Zooropa, which was perhaps surprising in the show, or perhaps not if you consider the whole Zoo TV concept, obviously trying to dissociate themselves from something they've done before. They quote heavily, obviously, from the album Pop, also Joshua Tree, Unforgettable Fire, and a few move from war, and I'm reluctant to give too much away from the show other than to tell you that it certainly is a spectacle. There is a Spinal Tap moment, deliberate or otherwise, that has to be seen to be believed, and certainly an interesting way to spend a couple of hours. We have an interesting way to spend the next 20 minutes, namely more conversation from Bono and more music from you two. Please stay with us.
All mixed up and it's confusing. That's my delight. And that's what I want from you too. I just think that's when we're at our most exciting. That's when we're playing right in the middle of the mainstream and still being irritant.
You're listening to a special edition of Live in Toronto. Kim Hughes in conversation with you too.
Kim Hughes, and we return now to my conversation with you too.
But it's interesting in a way, just to sort of pick up on something you said and something that I kind of perceived about the group and being, you know, admitted careerists from the get-go and wanting to achieve that level. It's sort of like putting a ceiling on your own best possible moment. It's like, you know, once you get there, it's not really a surprise because it's the thing you always wanted.
So we haven't got there yet.
Have you not?
No. Not
on a spiritual level, what hasn't been fulfilled? I mean, because clearly, on a material level, everything.
Yeah, but it's not. I'm not talking about material things. I'm talking about musical things, musical ambitions. That's where. I mean, we had the material things covered, age 23, age 24. So we can afford to bite the hand that feeds. We can do anything we want, and that's why we're. That's why you have to watch us, because it's not just lip service. We can genuinely do anything we want, and we're lucky, and we've been spoiled to be put in that position, and very few groups have been able to do that. But we don't measure our success by our record sales. We measure them by something completely different, you know. We're songwriters now in a way that maybe we weren't when we started off, so we like to get off the songs, get those songs off. But at the same time, we're still as innovative as we've always been. And so we get a thrill out of changing what people might think of what a band is capable of, you know. And things have gotten very safe in what you might call white rock. And white rock is at the end of the 20th century is completely caught up in nostalgia, and it is mostly irrelevant in my mind. If somebody writes a great song, it doesn't matter. My comments don't matter. But basically, the stance of white rock is very boring. Say, if you compare it to hip hop, where people are making the music of the next century, using the technology that's around, abusing it, making records for like $5,000, $10,000, and getting their point of view across with a groove at the heart of it. And you look at what's going on across the road in our camp, and it's embarrassing. People are rebelling against their parents using their parents' music. I mean, it's sad. It is so sad. And, you know, as I say, all of that means nothing. If somebody if one of these nostalgia acts writes a great song, then it transcends the problem. But I'm just saying, by and large, the stance is dope.
We're on the edge from the album Pop. That is the song Mofo. And as we've mentioned, you two will be coming to town and bringing Pop Mart to this part of the world once again in October, October 26th and 27th at Sky Dome. They're going to be doing Europe in the middle there. And we're actually going to be doing two shows in Edmonton, so clearly a very big market for the band in this side of the world. Just before we do our last break and come back with final words with Bono, a couple of quick things to mention. First of all, big thanks to Rob Johnston for going along to Winnipeg and making this all come together. together. Also, thanks to our friend John Reed and Alana Rabinovich from A&M. Very helpful to have you on board. And also to Chris Pack for being our excellent producer. And keep in mind, coming up at 8 o'clock is the brother, and he's going to take you through the evening. So be listening for that. We'll take a break. We'll be
back. Most of the years, Chris, maybe the scale of what we're doing has changed. Whether you're seeing us in a stadium or an arena or a theater or maybe even in a club, it'll basically be the same four guys putting in the same effort. And that's the way it's always been.
You're listening to a special edition of Live in Toronto. Kim Hughes in conversation with you too.
Well, we're just about done, and it seems fitting somehow to leave the final words of the evening to the man himself. Here's Bono.
Most of the music I listen to, it's probably not mainstream music. I would listen to your station if there was one in Dublin. I would listen to it all the time. But still, the excitement I get is when I hear some extraordinary guitar sound in daytime radio in London on BBC One. I think when I hear Edge go into that little cheesy sound in the middle of the discotheque, dee, 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 I go, yes, you know, or whoever it is who's doing that, that's when I get excited, is when I hear, is when I saw the Sex Pistols on Top of the Pops, or when I saw, you know, I like it when it's all mixed up, when it's confusing. That's my delight is then that. That's what I want from you too. I just think that's when we're at our most exciting. It's when we're playing right in the middle of the mainstream, but still being an irritant.
So let's end on this point. On a very personal level, what are you still dying to do?
I still feel that the songwriting can be pushed further. As a singer, I'm quite frustrated because I only came into singing in the last few years. Singing was the thing we used to do as soon as the words were finished. It was like, and the words were usually finished on the last day of the record. And I never used to think that much about my singing. We would never even think about the key, for instance, of a song. And I think there's much more for me to do as a singer, and I'd like to push the songwriting in two extremes: one, as far out as we can possibly get it, into the pink noise, and on another level, into just pure joy of a great Beach Boys song, or Brian Wilson, you know, he blows me as the guy is blowing me at the moment. That's what I'm looking for. Just pushing out the extremes of what we do.